Daniel chapter 6, starting at verse 1. Darius the Mede decided to divide the kingdom into 120 provinces, and he appointed a high officer to rule over each province. The king also chose Daniel and two others as administrators to supervise the high officers and protect the king's interest. Daniel soon proved himself more capable than all the other administrators and high officers. Because of Daniel's great ability, the king made plans to place him over the entire empire. Then the other administrators and high officers began searching for some fault in the way Daniel was handling government affairs, but they couldn't find anything to criticize or condemn. He was faithful, always responsible, and completely trustworthy. Just reestablish what's going on here. This is Darius is the king of the Medo-Persian Empire. At the very, very, very end, like the last verse of the last chapter, the Babylonians were defeated, and Darius took over as the king of the Medo-Persian Empire. They've conquered Babylon, and rather than only using their people to be leaders, they are using the best and brightest from wherever they can find them. And so Daniel is one of those people. He's a holdover from the Babylonian government, and he's so qualified that he emerges as the singular cream of the crop of the administrators and officers. And I don't know that we necessarily get this. Like, this is a massive empire, and he is at the top in terms of what he offers and the ability that he has, and so he gets promoted as such. It's important to note, I think, before we get any further, that sometimes when we read this story, it's framed that what happens is, you know, because Daniel is such a good Christian, he wasn't a Christian, he was before Jesus, but he's such a good Jesus follower, that's why they wanted to attack him. That's not the case. What follows is because he was really good at his job. That's why people were ultimately jealous of him. Daniel was embodying what Jeremiah encouraged the exiles to do when he told the exiles to build homes, to plan to stay, to plant gardens, eat the food they produce, you know, to settle down, to work for the peace and prosperity of the city where they had been sent into exile. Daniel is embodying that, and he's doing a great job at it, and everybody else got jealous because that great job got recognized. He's working for the peace and prosperity of the city where he is in exile, and he's doing it in an amazing way. It's so good, in fact, that even those who can't stand him because he's so good at it, they can't find any fault in him. They try as hard as they can to pick something out to blame him for or to say he's not doing it well, and they can't find anything. So let's continue and see what their response is to not being able to find anything. Verse 5. So they concluded, our only chance of finding grounds for accusing Daniel will be in connection with the rules of his religion. Here's where religion starts coming in. It's not that that's a problem, it's that they can't manipulate anything else to get him in trouble. So the administrators and high officers went to the king and said, long live King Darius. We are all in agreement, we administrators, officials, high officers, advisors, and governors, that the king should make a law that will be strictly enforced. Give orders that for the next 30 days, any person who prays to anyone, divine or human, except to you, your majesty, will be thrown into the den of lions. And now, your majesty, issue and sign this law so it cannot be changed, an official law of the Medes and Persians that cannot be revoked. So King Darius signed the law. Can you guess who's missing in the all of us agree? Daniel is not a part of the all of us. That's one of the great things in any organization when people come and say, like, everybody says, usually it's not, but clearly Daniel has been visibly faithful to Yahweh throughout his decades of service. He's been serving foreign kings, but he's remained faithful to Yahweh. And it's faithfulness to God that becomes the only thing the opponents feel that they can exploit to get rid of Daniel. So they lie. You know, this, we're all in agreement. They play on the king's ego. You know, people should only worship you, your majesty. And they manipulate. You know, they should be thrown into a den of lions and make this law that it can't be revoked. They do all of this to orchestrate Daniel's demise, despite the king's fondness for Daniel. The king is being played here. So the king signs this into law. We pick it up in verse 10. But when Daniel learned that the law had been signed, he went home and knelt down as usual in his upstairs room with his window open toward Jerusalem. He prayed three times a day, just as he had always done, giving thanks to his God. It's important to notice that Daniel is not making some type of political statement here. It's not even really a religious statement. It isn't radical religious disobedience. This isn't, oh, the king's going to do that. Well, I'll show him. Daniel is doing something he has always done. He's practicing consistent prayer, maintaining his connection with Yahweh. And I love that his window is open towards Jerusalem. All of this time, serving a foreign king, he's never forgotten where his true citizenship is. And he's keeping his eye in that direction. And finally, note what he does. He doesn't lament. He doesn't scream and cry and say, these horrible people are after me, God. He says he's giving thanks to his God. He knows what the law is. He could easily, and it would make sense, it does to me anyway, that he would go and lament. He could vent his anger. He could take the psalms of the imprecatory psalms, these ones filled with rage, and he could pray those, hoping for justice to be served against his enemies. It doesn't say he does that. He goes and gives thanks. Let's keep going in verse 11. Then the officials went together to Daniel's house and found him praying and asking for God's help. He is doing more than giving thanks. He's asking for God's help. So they went straight to the king and reminded him about his law. Did you not sign a law that for the next 30 days, any person who prays to anyone, divine or human, except to you, your majesty, will be thrown into the den of lions? Yes, the king replied, that decision stands. It is an official law of the Medes and Persians that cannot be revoked. Then they told the king, that man Daniel, one of the captives from Judah, is ignoring you and your law. He still prays to his God three times a day. Hearing this, the king was deeply troubled, and he tried to think of a way to save Daniel. He spent the rest of the day looking for a way to get Daniel out of this predicament. Here we see the king realizes he's been manipulated and played, he's been trapped, and he is really upset about it. He tries to focus on how he can save this man that he highly values. And obviously he gets no help from the advisors that he would normally go to for help because they were the ones who manipulated him in the first place. So what do they do? Let's keep reading. In the evening, the men went together to the king and said, your majesty, you know that according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, no law the king signs can be changed. So at last, the king gave orders for Daniel to be arrested and thrown into the den of lions. And the king said to him, may your God, whom you serve so faithfully, rescue you. This is a fascinating thing to say, because in a way he is kind of praying to a god other than himself. But anyway, he doesn't invoke any of his gods on Daniel's behalf. Perhaps he realizes that just as this is beyond his ability to do anything, so it's beyond what his gods can do. But maybe, just maybe, Daniel's God can do something that will save Daniel. So verse 17, a stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den. The king sealed the stone with his own royal seal and the seals of his nobles so that no one could rescue Daniel. That last phrase, so that no one could rescue Daniel, is translated a bit more literally in some other translations. It may look different in your translation. Some of them say, so that Daniel's situation couldn't be changed. And I actually like that. Well, he wants Daniel to be saved. The other possibility is there that someone could come and mess things up to make sure Daniel does not survive. And so he does something to make sure that only God can do something here. For good or for ill, no one else is going to mess with this. We, like the king, leave Daniel there for a moment. We get to verse 18. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night fasting. He refused his usual entertainment and couldn't sleep at all that night. Very early the next morning, the king got up and hurried out to the lion's den. When he got there, he called out in anguish, Daniel, servant of the living God. Again, Fascinating that he's already moved to this place. Was your God, whom you serve so faithfully, able to rescue you from the lions? Even in these words, it seems like something has shifted in his own heart overnight, as though he's come to recognize something different about Daniel's God, the living God, the God who is alive. He recognized that if Daniel has been saved, it will be because of his God's work. And in verse 21, Daniel answered, "Long live the king. My God sent his angel to shut the lions' mouths so that they would not hurt me, for I have been found innocent in his sight, and I have not wronged you, your majesty." The king was overjoyed and ordered that Daniel be lifted from the den. Not a scratch was found on him, for he had trusted in his God. So Daniel's been delivered. And what comes next? I got to be honest, I really struggle with this. Verse 24. Then the king gave orders to arrest the men who had maliciously accused Daniel. He had them thrown into the lion's den, along with their wives and children. The lions leapt on them and tore them apart before they even hit the floor of the den. The king, who didn't want to throw Daniel in, but had to because of the law he'd passed, now, without a law forcing his hand, throws in the men who had plotted against Daniel, along with their families. This is a very common Old Testament theme, that God will avenge his people. And for exiles in any era, it can be a big comfort to know that God is going to deal with the people who are causing the suffering. But I think it's good to point out that there's no hint that Daniel asked for this to happen. While we should rest in God meting out justice when we're sure it's demanded, we shouldn't take this as an example or license to act in vengeful ways or react violently against those who oppose us or even try to harm us. This is a human response. There is not a sense in which God says, you should do this now. Verse 25, then King Darius sent this message to the people of every race and nation and language throughout the world. Priests, peace and prosperity to you. I decree that everyone throughout my kingdom should tremble with fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and he will endure forever. His kingdom will never be destroyed and his rule will never end. He rescues and saves his people. He performs miraculous signs and wonders in the heavens and on earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. As a text that's being written for exiles in another area, like this hymn is for those exiles to hold on to. That God is the one who will rescue. This is something that has been the theme throughout the book of Daniel. God's kingdom is never going to end, even when it looks like it has. God is going to reign, even when it looks like he doesn't. God's kingdom will not be destroyed. He will rescue and save, just like he did for Daniel. Verse 28, so Daniel prospered during the reign of King Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Again, this whole thing reaffirms some of the consistent messages of the book of Daniel. That God's ultimately going to receive honor, that God is going to be with those who are faithful in their call to seek the good of the land they are in while remaining faithful to God, that God remains in control. That's something that we've talked about throughout the course of this book. And so I'm not going to spend a bunch of time talking about that today. As we consider what message, what alternative perspective or understanding does this offer those living as exiles, I want to focus on something that is newly revealed about Daniel in this passage. Something that's an essential reminder and encouragement to all who live in a world that isn't centered on the kingdom of God. And that's going back to the fact that Daniel did nothing out of the ordinary in this passage. He heard the law that had been established and did, as it says in the text, just what he'd always done. Again, this wasn't a bold act of civil disobedience. It wasn't a public display of religious antagonism. He went home and did what he'd always done to stay connected with God and keep his eyes focused on the kingdom where his ultimate citizenship lay. As we've read through and we see how Daniel's been able to serve well and hold on to this connection with God, keep hearing God's voice, there's this part of me that wonders, how did he do that? And this seems to answer that question. He's been able to walk this line of serving faithfully and remaining connected with God because he's adopted these consistent private practices to maintain it, that fostered that life. Last week we talked about how Daniel wasn't puffed up by the complimentary words of the queen mother or brought down by the demeaning words of the king. And this is how he was able to stay rooted and grounded, not brought up or low by other people's reactions to him. He has spent decades putting down roots into God's love and care for him, fostering that relationship. In a world filled with temptations and pleasures and opportunities to chase power, plenty of reasons to be angry or want revenge, Daniel instead sought God. Day after day, three times a day, he turned his eyes towards the kingdom of his citizenship and turned his heart and words towards Yahweh. I want to have that kind of rootedness Daniel had. I want to have the kind of courage he had. I want to have his ability to stay true to the ways of God's kingdom while living well in the world that God has me. But I can't do that if I don't foster it, if I don't work at it. This idea of having intentional, regular practices to strengthen and maintain our life with God, it's has a deep and ancient history. The Jews practiced it. And then in the early church, the first Christians who had been raised as Jews, they took some of those formational practices and they transformed them as practices that centered them around Jesus. They reinterpreted them around Jesus, empowered by the Spirit of Christ. And then as Christianity grew beyond its Jewish roots, it kept this emphasis on regular formational practices, regular prayer, hymns, recitation of oral creeds, the gathering of the church, generosity to those in need. These were consistent features of the Christian life in the early days, and they stayed there as the church matured. Over 1,500 years ago, Benedict of Nursia developed something that he called his Little Rule for Beginners. It was a guide for how to live well, to stay listening to and connected with God amid both religious and secular pressures. As church history has gone on, many monastic communities have developed their own rules, they call them, over subsequent centuries. And this idea of a thoughtfully developed rule of life has regained traction beyond monasteries in recent decades. At its core, a rule of life, as it's called, isn't about obeying a structure. It isn't some secret Christian path to maturity. It's not like if you check these boxes, everything's going to be good. A rule of life begins with a recognition that we are all growing in some direction. Brent preached on this a few weeks ago, that we're all being shaped by something. The question is what? We're all growing in some direction. The question is, what is that direction? And a rule of life recognizes that the practices we have in our life, whether we do them intentionally or without intent, they shape the direction that we grow. And so for a Christian, a rule of life is meant to be a set of intentional practices that help us grow in directions that align with the life God has for us. Healthy directions. I find it helpful to understand what this ancient word rule comes from, because we often think of it as something that is binding and restrictive. The ancient rule has a couple of ideas behind it. The first is the idea of a trellis in a garden. Any gardeners here? I did not realize how incredible a trellis could be until we visited the home of someone who was in our church in Oakville, and he was a city plot. The ground area, maybe 10 by 10, and he probably had a couple hundred square foot of growing area because the whole thing was built with trellises. So his garden was like walking into something you see in this picture, and just in case you can't see it, that's melons in the picture. And he had that type of thing in his whole garden. So it wasn't just this. It was all up and above and around. He used trellises to help things grow strong and healthy. A trellis is that thing that it grows on. It doesn't give health. It needs the sun and the water, just like any other plant. But it provides a framework that helps it grow towards the sun while remaining rooted in the soil so that it can be healthy. A rule of life does this for us in an intentional way. If we, again, we all have practices that we do that shape us. The question is, are they shaping us in the direction of things that help us to be healthy? This idea of a rule is like this trellis. Gives us things to help us grab onto that keep us open to the voice of God and the work of God in our lives in an intentional and thoughtful way. Second idea behind the same original word is that of a guidepost or a railing, something you can grab onto to steady you, or if it's dark, to help you know the way. I love that picture, that even when everything is dark around us, we know we can hold on to and cling on to that. It's not the light. It's not the source of light, but it can help steady us and keep us going in the right direction while we wait for that light or the source of life to emerge. In this story, Daniel seems to have developed a version of this, which he had maintained for decades. He'd maintained it through being taken from his homeland. He'd maintained it through temptations to rely on the gods of Babylon. He'd maintained it while being offered rewards and wealth and opportunity. He maintained it when he was threatened or belittled. He'd maintained it through an entire empire change. And he'd maintained it when he was told it would cost him his life. Because it was here, through these regular practices, that he heard God, that he kept his eyes on God's kingdom ways. It's here that he received the sustenance that he needed to, as it would say in the New Testament, to live and move and have his being. I'm just going to ask, like, we're not going to get too much into this, but what are some of the rhythms and relationships that help to create, redeem, sustain, or transform our life in the way of Jesus, to help us to live fully in the way of Jesus? Something for you to think about, because, again, if you're not doing this intentionally, you're going to be growing in another direction unintentionally. These things may not be the same for everyone. In fact, likely they won't be, because we're wired differently. Some of them you may be aware of only when you stop doing them. If you ever have practices where, you know, maybe you don't like, maybe you go for a regular walk, physical practice, you go for a regular walk, but you don't know how much it's helping you until you go for a week without going for a walk. You know, sometimes it's when you stop doing things that you realize, oh, that's really important to me. Sometimes these practices may not seem spiritual on the surface, at least not obviously so. This could be solitary practices. They could be practices done within community. So I'm going to take the time to do this. What are some practices and relationships that help you create, redeem, sustain, and transform your life to be lived in the way of Jesus? It can be encouraging to hear from other people. So I'm going to try to remember to repeat what you say out loud for the people online. But what are some practices for you that help sustain this life for you? Here.
Coming to church.
Yeah, being... Yeah.
And even if I watch online, it's different than being here.
Yeah, so coming to church and being together is something different than you, and miss it when it doesn't happen. Anybody else?
Try to regularly spend some time in the Bible, even if it's just a short amount.
Yeah.
Or a small passage every day just to help ground me.
Yeah, regular Bible reading, engaging it, even if it's just a short section. Yeah. Prayer, just a practice of gratitude, prayer of thanks every morning. Yeah, Mary, you had something?
I start every morning with God in some way.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's in Bible reading, sometimes it's listening to Christian podcasts, sometimes it's listening to Christian music, sometimes it's just sitting there and having a conversation with Him, and every morning starts with Him.
Yeah.
And I really do feel it and miss it when I go.
Yeah, starting every morning in some way with God. And it's interesting, as you say that, you talk about all the different ways you do it. Some of us are wired where it's going to be the same thing every day. Others of us are wired where it's like, we need something different. Like, it's going to change. Yep, you got something, Carrie?
I was just going to say, listening to Life 100. Listen. Yeah, yeah, and then you're listening to the preaching, or sometimes it's the music.
Listening to Christian radio, yeah. Did you have something, Sabrina?
Stories too. Yeah, the Good News Report.
Yeah, you're hearing good news? Sabrina, sorry. Yeah, that time with God, and you're setting up that day well and listening. That's great. Thank you. Thanks. Did you have something, Patrick? Yeah. Yeah, to practice just that seeing yourself, that deep I am, as you said, like that God, that image of God in others. Yeah. Marion.
We pray for our kids every morning. It's the same prayer every day.
Yeah. Praying for your kids every morning, even when you don't like them that morning. Yeah, praying over them. It's awesome. Yeah, go on.
I've been listening this year to the Bible in a Year podcast, and that's really helpful in terms of, I don't know, I know how it's going to go with it.
Yeah.
But it's definitely different than like your casual lectionary. So
yeah. Yeah.
Going through the entirety of it, remembering things that I might not have remembered.
Listening to the Bible in a year in a way that you aren't setting the agenda for what's to come that day, and giving that space for God to speak through. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Lori. Okay.
Music,
yeah.
And every night, even Curtis joins me and we pray for our families.
Yeah.
Every single night. And often it's a similar
prayer. Awesome. Yeah, Lori, just saying every morning and evening that prayer, even coming together to pray for families and a lot of music involved. I'm just repeating it for the sake of the people online. I find Sabbath, taking a day to remember that I'm not about what I produce, is very, very helpful. And definitely feel that when I don't take a Sabbath. There's lots of different things that we could do. I have a good friend who does woodworking. And it's a very meditative and creative thing that is very soul feeding when he's it's working in the garden or riding a horse or it could be different for each of us, but finding these regular practices that feed our soul, that open us up to hearing God and being shaped in this life that God has for us. That's beautiful. I'm going to ask another question. We're not going to talk about this one, but sometimes it's not the practices that shape those things. Maybe we need to let go of some practices that don't shape those things. So it's worth asking, what are some practices and relationships that work against you creating, redeeming, sustaining, and transforming your life to be lived in the way of Jesus? How might you need to rebuild or reframe your trellis so it's growing in the right direction? Something to think about. We want to have the courage and confidence that Daniel did. We want to be able to hear God's voice and serve and live well wherever we find ourselves. But it doesn't happen by accident. And usually by the time we get into those situations, if we haven't been developing that connection with God, it's too late. We wonder how people can hold on, and it's because they've been doing these practices for a long time. May God give us wisdom and strength to discern and develop these habits and practices in a way that help us hear God, to learn to live and love in His way.